electrical engineering from the Technical University at Darmstadt, Germany. He has worked for, he has done postgraduate studies at Stanford University. Has worked for Hewlett Packard. Is very active in the ANSI and IEC international standards. A delegate to CISPR. For all of you who don't live in the regulated world, that's a very important organization. And has been has a lifelong interest in audio, and I think you will be very informed and impressed with his presentation on accurate sound reproduction from two loudspeakers in a living room. I always like to say we haven't mastered stereo yet. We're already up to 14.2 surround. But without further delay, here is Siegfried.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Well, you have seen the slide, you know, for some time. Is the volume too high? It's okay? All right. The title, Accurate Sound Reproduction from Two Loudspeakers in a Living Room, there are three key words in here. One is accurate, the other one is two, and the third one is living room. When I talk about accurate, what I want to refer to is perceptually accurate. Not accurate in the physical sense of sound pressure, particle velocity, and time, but in the sense of perception, how we perceive sound. I also will talk only about two loudspeakers or stereo, rather than wave field synthesis or binaural reproduction, which are attempts to accurately reproduce a wavefront. This is not about that. And then the third word, living room, refers to the fact that sound reproduction often occurs in spaces that vary greatly, different shapes, different acoustic properties there. Not purposeful built rooms here. Okay, so let's get into it. And I show you, first of all, a picture of what is my living room. Now, I say this is my living room, and you probably believe that it is my living room. But when you look at this picture here really closely, all I really have projected here is a two-dimensional pattern of colors, shapes, forms. And what happens the moment this thing flashed up in your brain, you begin to analyze what this thing is. You put shapes together, recognize this as a lamp, here's a chair, there's a window, here are books. You also recognize that this is really a description of a three-dimensional object. Now, all this happened in your brain. And you took cues from the picture because you have lines of perspective here. Objects get smaller as they're further away. A very important element for this analysis here are the edges. We always look for edges. Anyone involved with photography or Photoshop or so knows about sharpening and things you can do there optically. But you look at this with two eyes, but really it would be perfectly sufficient to just look at it with one eye. The fact that you have two eyes and can have sort of stereo vision, three dimensions, two different pictures from each eye, doesn't really matter or doesn't really help you in this case. When you block off one eye, you see the same thing. The brain gets the same information as you have here. As a matter of fact, if this was on a glaring screen here with two-eye vision, you would pick up more reflections than you do just with one eye. And someone, I think it was Laurie, just told me, Laurie Finchen, told me recently that if you have a very high-resolution picture on, say, video screen, and you watch it with a single eye, it actually becomes three-dimensional. It sort of floats in space. I haven't done this experiment. I don't have a good display, but I think something worth experimenting. Maybe Laurie can comment on it later on. So anyways, all I'm trying to communicate here is that we are at this point here analyzing in our brain this picture here. And if you're audiophiles, you might go a step further and say, okay, I recognize this here as a loudspeaker. Don't quite know what these things are here. But I also see this guy has, oh, glass here, windows there, okay. And windows there, hard wall right back there. Well, there's something on the floor. Well, I sort of can imagine what these loudspeakers will sound like in that room. It's all sort of a process that goes on with, as you look at this picture. Now, let me, this is how we analyze the visual scene, and just imagine you were a software writer and had to come up with software that analyzes this picture and tells you what is in there, what is this? Just have this pixel pattern here and analyze what's in there. That's basically what's happening in your brain. Now I'll show you another picture. And what object is this here? Well, on first sight you say, oh yes, it's a wooden crate. But then when you look closer, you get cues that are not consistent with the memory of that you have of a wooden crate. So at this point, your brain is sort of a little bit confused. You know, you can't put it into any place, right? Is it a three-dimensional object? Could they ever build something like this? What is it? Okay. I just show it just to show you what goes on as you look at this picture here. And we do it totally unconsciously. Now let's talk about hearing. Here is sort of a look under the skin and under the bones of a human being. The two outer ears, can't show the inner ears. And then the brain, the two halves of the brain between the ears. And here we have waveforms impinging on the outer ear on both sides. And we hear something. Actually, these waveforms here are from a piece of a recording of a Mozart concerto, but you wouldn't recognize this, obviously, here. Okay? But given a sufficient number of these, the brain can not only recognize that there were some violins playing and some bassoons and what other instrument, but also who was the composer of that music. So it's all happening between the ears. Okay? Now, there is a description of the hearing process, of the problems with hearing, sort of from an engineering viewpoint, and it's given by Alfred Bregman, and many of you know who Alfred Bregman is. He wrote a book on auditory scene analysis. And I want to just read from his introduction just a short section to illustrate what the problem is and what goes on. And he says, and this is an introduction, by the way, he has a test CD with examples of this that apply to this auditory scene analysis. Anyways, he says, sound is a pattern of pressure waves moving through the air, each sound producing event creating its own wave pattern. The human brain recognizes these patterns as indicative of the events that give rise to them. A car going by, a violin playing, a woman speaking, and so on. Unfortunately, by the time the sound has reached the ear, the wave patterns arising from the individual events have been added together in the air so that the pressure wave that reaches the eardrum is the sum of the pressure patterns coming from the individual events. This summed pressure wave need not resemble the wave patterns of the individual sounds. As listeners, we are not interested in the sum pattern, but in the individual wave patterns arriving from the separate events. Therefore, our brains have to solve the problem of creating separate descriptions of the individual happenings. But it doesn't even know at the outset how many sounds there are, never mind what their wave patterns are. So the discovery of the number and nature of the sound source is analogous to the following mathematical problem. And here comes an engineering problem or math problem here. It goes as following. The number 837 is the sum of an unknown number of other numbers. What are they? And to give you a hint, there is a unique answer. There is a unique answer. This is basically what's happening. You receive the sum of sounds coming to your ears. They come from various sources. They all combine, just here like you have here. This is the sum of all the sounds that were there in that space that the person heard there. And there may be many sources of these sounds, people speaking, maybe you had a cocktail party or something, different conversations going on, okay? But you only hear the sum, everything together. And now the brain is able to sort of deconvolve all this and find out not only how many sources there were, but where they are located in space and make sense out of that whole thing. The ear brain processor really uses a lot of cues, and much of this has been studied and is known. We use things like the sound you can think of as a stream of pressure fluctuation. And in the brain, we can break it up into pieces that belong together. Just think of the cocktail party. You had a cocktail party. You have a conversation with someone standing in front of you. There's a conversation going on over here. You pick up pieces of that conversation. And while I'm talking to this person, if I want to, I can actually tune in to some conversation someplace else at the same time. I'm sure you have experienced this. I have to say, it takes quite a bit of processing power to do that. My native language is German, and it took me years to develop that ability in the English language, because you pick up just bits and pieces there, and you don't have, and I didn't have the memory bank of putting together what belongs together and making sense of things. There's a precedence effect. We use the head movement, the head-related transfer function, and one of the things that I think is really interesting is that we have the ability to extend and to change our perceptual acoustic horizon. By the way, can you see what's here at the bottom of the screen? Okay, I'll read it. We can change our acoustic horizon by attention. You can focus on sounds, and you can ignore sounds. And something that I'm sure people who do recordings have often observed there, that when you listen back to a recording, you all of a sudden you hear sounds, background noises or so that you were not aware of while the recording took place, because we blissfully ignored it. It wasn't of interest to us at the time. It wasn't within the horizon. Now, Günther Theile, someone you probably also know, has, 1987, maybe even earlier, but this is the earliest reference that I have, talks about the association model of perception. And this is a model, and just very briefly here to describe it, out here is the auditory scene, and he calls it the elaboration of the gestalt. This is the outer ear. This block represents the outer ear. So here you would have the head-related transfer function. Sound arriving from different angles has different spectral content as it reaches the eardrum. And then this goes up to here. This is the acoustical stimulus generated at each ear, left and right ear. And then in the behind the eardrum, so to speak, there is some frequency analysis happening, time domain analysis happening. But there's also what he calls the location determining stage here. where the head-related transfer function is used to determine from which direction does the sound come. And one example that I think is very intriguing is, and you can do that yourself, experiment it with yourself. If you are standing, two people talking to each other, and you pay attention to how the other person sounds to you, okay? And say the conversation continues speaking, and now you turn 90 degrees. So the sound from that person reaches first this ear, and then around the head, the other ear. And you know, of course, that the frequency response to the two ears has changed dramatically. Yet, the person still sounds the same, has the same timbre as when you look at the person directly. Well, what's happening is, Tyler's hypothesis is that inside the brain, there is sort of like an inverse filter. Once you know the location and determine location from precedence and head motion, now we can filter out the changes in frequency response that were caused by the outer ear or by the rotation of the head, and then use that information to process here to recognize what was a gestalt, what was that sound coming in, was it a person speaking, was it piano playing, or what was it? Okay, just to give a little flavor here. Now, let's get to the auditory scene that is really of interest here for sound reproduction. Here's the, as an example, an orchestra in a hall, and you see the visual picture there, but there's also a whole acoustic scene. There are the direct sound sources down here, the orchestra, the organ. The sounds generated here get reflected from the walls. There's the sound sources from the audience in here. Sound is absorbed. So someone sitting out there perceives a certain auditory scene which is analyzed and creates a certain experience, a certain impression. Now what we're trying to do is, in sound reproduction, we are trying to reproduce this auditory scene that happened in real life at some later time in a different environment. This living room represents an auditory scene too. So the game is to create or recreate this scene inside this other acoustic space to the point where you can hear. To the point where you can hear not only the individual instruments, but hopefully also get a good sense of the space and how these instruments were arranged in space, because that's in the auditory process. All that information is what we're getting. So accuracy in that sense, now accurate sound reproduction is equal then to creating an auditory illusion of the original auditory scene. It's an illusion, obviously. I mean, there's no physical orchestra there in your living room there, so it's all happening between your ears. It's all in your brain. But this illusion can be quite convincing and quite satisfying. Okay, now, in order to create this illusion, it is important that all the misleading cues during playback and during recording are minimized. Otherwise, the brain has trouble to create this. And one of the things that I always use is when I listen to a new system or unfamiliar thing, I rely very much on long-term listening. Sound systems can be very impressive on first hearing there. But after a while, you say, I'm sort of tired. I don't want to hear anything more. If you have the other reaction and say, oh, I want to hear this, let me try this CD or this, then I know something is right. In the first case, where you get tired, the brain has to work too hard to make up for the things that are missing or the things that are wrong. It gets the wrong cues. If it is natural, then you fall into it, you love it, you know. So it's a very important criterion. So what are these cues now that we have to minimize? And let's first talk about the loudspeaker. Obviously, and I think everybody would agree, the on-axis frequency response is most important. It's sort of, you have to get that one right. It's like in mathematics, it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. You have to get the frequency or the axis frequency response right, meaning you get rid of too many variations. And I don't want to go into details on what these variations are. But next to it is you have to get the directivity of the source right. That's an important parameter, and we'll talk a lot about that more. Then any linear distortions like resonances or stored energy has to be minimized. Then nonlinear distortion. And finally, diffraction effects, cabinet edges, the things that give away that where the loudspeaker is, those things have to be minimized there. Now, I wrote this in the order of priority, the way I see the priority. First, frequency response, polar pattern, linear distortion, nonlinear distortion, and finally, cabinet edge diffractions, things like this. You may notice nonlinear distortion is fairly far down on the list of things here. I firmly believe there is a level that's good enough and today can be achieved in drive units. It's not that difficult to do. Now, let's look at the room. What does the room contribute or do that we don't want? What could be give misleading cues from the room? Well, there is, everybody knows there are the low-frequency modes and low-frequency resonances. There's a reverberation, like how live, how dead is the room. There may be specular reflections that give you misleading cues. And also very important is the symmetry of the setup of the loudspeakers relative to left and right, relative to where you're sitting here. Like these loudspeakers up there are set up symmetrical, not completely with the whole room there, but it's certain symmetry with respect to the room, which is important. Now, this listing here, this listing is in reverse order of priority. Please note that I think symmetry is number one, reflections number two, reverberation, and the thing that everybody likes to talk about, the low frequency modes of the room, so I think they are really not that important. But that, assuming that other things are done right, okay? They can be very important if other things are wrong. All right, now, loudspeaker and room, of course, interact, they become engaged with each other, because when you have a source, say here's a room corner, here you have a dipole source, you have images in the walls. If a person sits here, sitting on axis, with respect to the sidewall reflection, well, the person is in the null for this dipole. For the rear wall reflection, it's also still pretty close to being in the null. This reflection here, which is a double reflection, there you are on axis again, and it's out of phase where it gets there. So the room certainly and the loudspeaker interact. No question about that. I'm coming back to my room now, and in particular I want to talk about these loudspeakers here, a dipole and a monopole, listening position A, close up, and B, further away. And to give you more detail, these are the two loudspeakers. One is here, I call them Pluto. It's actually a pretty good monopole or omnidirectional source begins to get directional above 3 kilohertz or so because of the size of the tweeter here, but it's upwards firing, so at low frequency it's quite omni. I just have it as a two-way here at home. I have a subwoofer also, you see it on the picture down here. So it's quite omnidirectional. By contrast, the loudspeaker on the right here, this is a dipole. You have two tweeters moving in the direction of the arrows. You have a mid-range that's open in the back, so it's dipole here. Two woofers back to back for distortion cancellation, but the cones move, like the arrows say, in the same direction. And here the polar patterns, the dipole and the monopole, which then becomes forward pointing at high frequencies. Now, those two loudspeakers I have set up in my room, and the setup is like this here, symmetrical with respect to the boundaries of the room, although they are glass here on both sides. Here are the dipoles, the monopoles, listening position A and position B, and the monopoles are closer to the listener here because the dipole is more directive, has a factor 3 directivity, and so to be exact, talking about critical distances, this distance here should be 60% of that one, but that didn't work out quite like this in the setup, didn't seem necessary either. But anyways, the subtended angle that the listener at A has here, this angle is the same for this speaker as it is for the dipole. So the incidence of the direct sound on the ear comes from the same angle of both loudspeakers. So they're in that line. Okay. Now, the obvious thing to do, of course, and I think lots of people do this, say, okay, what is the frequency response of these two loudspeakers in this room at listening position A? And I show you what that looks like. Here's the frequency response. The upper two pictures are the dipole. This is the monopole. You see, this is the actual measurement in a 200 millisecond time window, so fairly long. Okay. So you can see here, that's in order to get the resolution, about 5 hertz resolution here. And this upper curve is just this curve filtered with 1/3 octave and then offset, so you can see it more readily, sort of the average, 1/3 octave average of this curve here. Now, when you look at the dipole left and right, you say, oh yeah, there are differences for one thing. They are not symmetrical. That's not true. And if you look at it compared to the monopole, they have sort of a general same trend, certainly not at low frequencies. You see these variations at low frequencies. And you would think, well, they're two different loudspeakers. Can't really say whether they're any good or so from these measurements. Because it's not just a measurement of the loudspeaker, it's also a measurement of the room. Both data are in there. And this would be very difficult to sort of untangle them, you know, with our instrumentation. We can't quite do the process that the ear-brain system does. As a matter of fact, I never design a loudspeaker inside a room. I always make measurements outdoors, free space measurements, maybe with ground plane over the ground plane, but not with walls around it there. And then move it in the room and rarely do anything to the loudspeaker after that to do any correction for the room. And I'll get back to that later. Now, frequency response is just one description. The time domain description, for a time domain description, I think we should look at the reflections that the loudspeaker generates in the room. And here is a little model that I put together, a dipole loudspeaker in a room corner, and the walls are completely reflective. It's just glass here. Hopefully your listening room isn't quite like that. But here you can see the mirror images, all the images of this loudspeaker. Here's a rear wall speaker. You see the backside of this speaker. Here is the image in the floor. So when you look at this, you get the reflection from the rear wall and the floor, R plus F. This is a sidewall speaker. So from the perspective of this picture, you're almost in the null of this dipole here. There is a floor reflection also from the side. there is a rear and side wall reflection, here's a rear side wall and floor reflection. And here's a floor reflection that people like to talk so much about. And if you put a piece of carpet over it, maybe you can do something about it. Now, to measure reflections, I need a short click type signal. And I like to use a tone burst, a shaped tone burst. Here's a four cycle burst with an envelope, that's the Blackman envelope there. And that is done so that the frequency spectrum of this burst here falls, and particularly on the low side, falls as fast as possible. This four-cycle burst covers about an octave at minus 9 dB width there. And when you look at the envelope on a logarithmic scale, which is the energy time curve or the magnitude of the analytic signal, you see this lower curve. Now, let's apply a burst like this to the loudspeaker. And here again, upper one are the dipole and the monopole below here. What you're seeing is this first big spike is a direct sound. Okay, this is over a 50 millisecond window. And all these graphs are normalized so that the direct sound is up at the top of the scale. Are we overheating the projector, or what's going on? So you see here the various reflections. And to me, at least, I must say, it was surprising how many there are. You know, we like to always think, oh, the floor reflection surely should be the big one, and the sidewall reflection. And sure, they're in there, but there are many, many more. And you can see from the previous picture, which showed you all the images, that is true. Now, the reflection pattern is different for the monopole. First of all, you notice that the general level is lower, and that is because the speakers are closer, positioned closer, so the direct sound is relatively larger than the reflected sound here. There's also what comes into a little bit is that 3 kHz we are getting into the directional behavior of the tweeter here, so it doesn't illuminate everything quite as much as a monopole. But what's interesting is when I look at the power spectrum of this time section here. Okay? Okay, you will see it again. What's going on? Any idea? What this is? The computer on the monitor, nothing happens there. Or is there a cable? Cable. Okay. Well, now you see it. No, you don't. So look quickly. anyways, so in your memory, try to store these pictures.
Say, Frank, what if we changed to 1024 by 768 and the projector can track it better?
That's what we did before.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we did before.
Actually, I worked on doing that, and I see now, though, that the projector is seeing something else. So we might want to try repeating that setting. See if you can see that.
Okay. Yeah. Is there a computer expert here? Because now we are doing a highly risky... Okay. Okay. Let's take a short break here. Now you see the beautiful world of
technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we put on that cable? That's another
XP.
It's XP.
There's always something new.
All right.
See you, Ranger.
We're on here, right? Yeah. Yeah. Is it like that better?
We'll see.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see. So let's move maybe a little faster so we can
catch it.
All right, well, enough of these pictures here. Just keep in mind, as the next slide, I want to show you what the power spectrum looks like of this signal here, the direct plus the reflection, and for the dipole and for the monopole. Okay, so let's do that. Okay. This is a 50 millisecond time record power spectrum of it. This is for the left dipole and this is for the left monopole. And here underlying this smooth curve is a direct signal and superimposed is the sum of direct plus reflections there. And you see that there is a pretty good, in both cases, a pretty good replication of the spectrum. In other words, what this really says is that the direct plus a reflection still preserves to be a pretty good copy of the direct sound. And I think that's a very key piece here for everything else that I'm now going to talk about. And I thought I'd do a little demo here. On the top left, you see the 3 kilohertz burst. And let me play you that 3 kilohertz burst. Okay. Now, you heard the burst, but I'm, at least from here, I could also hear the room in the burst. You hear that? Yeah, hear the ringing. Now, the picture below here, it's a 200 millisecond record of the right loudspeaker, the dipole, in my room. So let me play that. You hear it's a direct plus a reflection, right? Now, I don't know what it is for you out there, and I know when I do this test at home, and I play this first signal here, and then play over the same loudspeakers this signal here. All of a sudden, you hear the room much more strongly. Like it's not that pronounced in the first thing, not like this one. I bet you if we it's too loud.
No.
Okay.
I'm getting rid of the back reflection.
Oh, okay. I bet if you recorded this signal here in this room, and then we played it back here, you would be aware much more of the reverberation in the room than you do when you hear it direct. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, just an observation. Okay, now here comes the observation, and I'm skipping a lot of experiments that I've done here in the comparison of these two loudspeakers here. And the observation is that the dipole and the monopole loudspeakers sound almost identical, both in their spectral balance and overall clarity, despite the differences in the measured room response and the measured burst response, the tone burst reflection response. The phantom imaging is very similar, it's precise, but with greater depth for the dipole. And both have the characteristics that when you play them, that the loudspeaker in the room disappear. Two very different loudspeakers, one an omni, the other one a dipole. Loudspeakers that illuminate acoustically the room very differently, and I must say, to me, this was really quite a startling observation. Because I didn't build these monopoles here in order to do this kind of experiment. What I really built them for is I saw this tweeter here and I said, oh, this allows me to build a fairly decent omnidirectional source. And I was interested in omnidirectional source because I wanted to have a speaker without baffles to see if it has better imaging than, say, a dipole or another speaker. I wanted to compare to something that's just an acoustic point source. And then when I set them up and did some the first listening, I didn't at all expect that they would sound so similar. That wasn't part of the design here. I wanted to hear, do they image differently? That was what I was really after. And then to my surprise, I said, well, first of all, they sound very similar. Second, they image very, very similar, except in this dimension, in the stage depths there, which I don't really have a good explanation for, but it's just an observation. Okay, so based on these experiments, and I have this following postulate or hypothesis or whatever you want to call it, if we want to minimize the misleading cues that we get from the room during reproduction, we have to make sure that the spectrum of the reflections is the same as the direct sound. Sort of like you want to get copies back of the direct sound. Okay? The reflections have to be delayed, and there has to be a minimum delay, and I would say it's in the order of 6 milliseconds, or a pass length difference of 6 feet, or translate another way, the speakers have to be at least 3 feet away from reflecting surfaces there. And here comes the symmetry again. The reflections, the way they come, have to be symmetrical to, say, the sender axis of the speaker setup. Now, if we say, okay, this is a postulate, let's accept it, what does it mean? What do we have to do for the loudspeaker and the room to assure that this is happening? And this is now what the loudspeaker requirements are. What they point to is that we need a frequency-independent polar response. And the way to do that is there are not that many options in which you can do it. You can build an omnidirectional source. Of course, same radiation every angle. You can build a bidirectional or dipolar source. Or you can buy a unidirectional cardioid-type source. The point is that, as far as the loudspeaker is concerned, we want uniform illumination of the space. So it's the omnidirectional, I always say, it's like a bare light bulb that's sitting there. Light shines everywhere, illuminates everything. The dipole, it's like two flashlights, back to back, shining this way, that way. But the illumination is uniform at all frequencies. Or the color of the light doesn't change if you want to do the optical example there, okay? So that's one requirement for the loudspeaker. Now what does it mean for the room? In the room, you want to set up the loudspeakers symmetrical so the timing cues don't get skewed there, that the reflections come at you with the same kinds of delays, which means loudspeakers should be at least 3 feet from large surfaces. And if you have absorbing or diffusing materials in there, they should be frequency independent, which is not the case with practically all of these things that are in use these days. They are not frequency independent. They are usually just high frequency, effective at high frequency, attenuating or diffusing, not doing much at low frequencies. Okay. And all this, of course, is related to the precedents in the room. William Hartman has done a lot of interesting writing about the precedence effect, and he says the precedence effect in a room manifests in three ways. One is localization, in the sense that the direct and the reflected sound are heard as a single entity from the location of the direct sound. The Haas effect, which is the form of the precedence effect, the integration of a direct sound with a delayed sound and adding loudness. And finally, an effect here that I have not seen that much talked about, the reverberation. We are not normally much aware of reverberated sound, even when its energy is larger than that of the direct sound. See, like in this room, I, at least from the stage here, I hear a lot of reverberated sound. Okay. But we are normally not that much aware of it. Okay. Now, the precedence effect. I want to give you a little demo here. I don't know if it works in this hall here, in this auditorium. I'm using these big speakers here because I first intended to do it with these, but they're down below, and maybe there's a chance that it can be done here. This precedence effect I found on the internet just by Googling for precedence effect. It comes from the University of Chicago, the Pumney Hearing Institute there. So if you go on Google, you can find it yourself. It's nicely described there, and the WAV files are there, and you can download it yourself. But let me explain to you, first of all, what to look for here, what to hear. There are two click signals here, left and right. And the left click occurs 32 milliseconds before the one on the right. Then, and there are 12 of these pairs are presented here in the example. Then, this echo here, this delay, is delayed less. It's only 10 milliseconds behind this one. And then, and we have 12 of those pairs. And then finally, this click here and that one are only 2 milliseconds apart. Okay. And I can just play it to you, and you can read down below. But let's just play it and see what. Let me play it once. I will repeat it. Okay. When it starts out, let me describe what you're supposed to hear. I don't know whether you hear it here in this setting here. It starts out with two clicks. You hear two clicks there, okay? And they are coming from the direction of the first click. Here in the graph it says the left source, but I believe it's the files, the WAV files are the reverse there. It comes, at least at home, it comes from the other speaker there. So as the time delay becomes shorter between them, the 10 milliseconds, you hear the click only coming from one loudspeaker, from the first loudspeaker. And then as the time delay between them becomes even shorter, it moves between the loudspeakers, not exactly to the center, but still closer to the first loudspeaker. So this is precedence effect. So let me play it again here. Let me do it a few times.
It sounds like it's summed to mono for playback.
The last one sounds like summed to mono.
No, I think they all do.
They all do?
Yeah.
Okay, then it's not working here. Okay, sorry. Is that the same experience? Does it all sound like summed to mono? Now, you sit very much off-axis here. The effect supposedly, or it works. The ideal setup would be halfway between the speakers, which is the aisle here, and 45 or 90 degrees, 45 and 45 degrees to each loudspeaker. So nobody has that seat, unfortunately. Okay, so let's not spend time on it, but you get the idea. And like I said, you can find it on Google and can experiment it with yourself. There's another effect here. Oops. What I wanted. That's not there. All right. There's a Clifton effect. Again, you have pairs of clicks. A first click from the left source here, 10 millisecond delayed from the right loudspeaker. And you will hear those as two clicks initially, and then they merge into one click coming from the left speaker. Okay? When I turn it on, you probably hear two clicks, a click pair. And then it begins to get one click into the left speaker, coming from the left speaker. Then, after this has been repeated 12 times, they change the order. Now this one becomes the leading one, and that one the delayed one. But as the switching is done, the brain has been programmed now that the click comes from the left loudspeaker. Now I change order. And what happens is, for a short while, you hear two clicks again. And then after that, the brain reorients, and now here at the end, hears it coming from the other speaker. So let's see if that works to some extent. We'll see. Two clicks, one click, two clicks. Did it come to one click at the end? Let me do it again. When you hear, or after a while, when you hear the two clicks, that's when we're reversing the order, which one is leading, which side is leading there, and then after a while it merges. I think what is interesting here, it takes the brain a little while to process this information and sort of sort out what it wants to do with it. Which was, by the way, an experience that I also had when I compared the dipole and the monopole there. When you switch instantly, at least early on, I could almost sense that my brain, there's something happening there, because I'm listening to a very differently illuminated room, switching from one auditory scene to a different auditory scene. These days, after I've done it many times, that sort of sensation is not there, so apparently it's been programmed in, okay, I know, okay, pick up this different pattern recognition system. All right, are we doing on time? Okay. And finally, one last effect, the Franzen effect, which is really, I think, is a really neat effect, because it works very strongly. And what it is here, we have the left source, I'm turning on a sine wave, 1 kilohertz sine wave, and then that goes to zero. And as this goes to zero, on the right speaker, the same sine wave builds up, and then goes on and then shuts off, okay? But the perception is that the sound never leaves coming from the left loudspeaker. Okay, so let's do that. Let me do it again. Did it move for you, or did it stay with the same loudspeaker?
It moved.
Okay. Again, the explanation here is that we judge location by the initial transient. You know, when I turn on, it starts with a click, basically, you know, a sharp transient, and then goes out. And after a while, a sine wave is very difficult to localize where it's coming from. We go by transient. And you can see it here, I'm sure you can hear it here. When I do the same thing instead of a sine wave, I'm using noise. And so this is here. Did you hear it? No. Okay. While this is all just by way of fun and some explanations there, I think it all relates back to how our hearing system really has evolved as a survival mechanism there. It was very important for the species to determine the direction of any possible threat. You know, is there a tiger somewhere lurking over there? Or if I hear some noise there, you immediately need to know where is it coming from. Then you need to know how far is it. Okay, two important cues that are important for survival, right? If it's very far, well, you have a little time left. Yeah. The other thing is that this ability has to be developed or has developed, evolved, in very different environments. The acoustics of the open savanna are very different from the acoustics in a forest, where you have lots of reflections from leaves and trees and bounce there, and you hear some rustling or so. It's very different than hearing something in an open field there and locating it and trying to determine the distance. Yeah. And we have developed the ability to focus or pay attention to those sounds which are of interest. In other words, interest for survival. And sort of the static background noise we can ignore, because it's there, it doesn't present any danger. And so we can mentally, we can shut it out. And in a way, it seems to me that when we are playing back two loudspeakers in a room, the part that we are really interested in is a direct sound coming from the loudspeaker. Now, if the room also reflects the walls and we get copies of the direct sound back, we can very quickly identify and say, oh, that's just the room. It's really not of interest. It doesn't really add anything of importance to us. And that's, I think, how we use it in closed spaces. When you think about it, stereo is sort of a real strange system, because nowhere in nature will you ever have the experience of a phantom source between two loudspeakers, okay? Like if I was recorded monaurally and played back over these speakers, you would hear a phantom source coming from right in the center here. Well, nothing like that evolutionary has ever happened there. So now you sit here and you're presented with this sort of a dilemma. You don't know, you hear two sound sources, same sound coming from both. You don't know where it is, so in sort of an act of desperation, you say, well, it must be in the center here, right? But the moment that one of them becomes a little louder, you say, oh, no, it's over there, it's moved over there. Or if this one is delayed compared to that one, say, oh, the first one is really the important one, so it must be here. So those are the effects that stereo then uses in playback. Okay, and just a few words about recording. Of course, in recording, and traditionally in recording, we focus very much on capturing the direct sound. And that is done because recording engineers want clarity. Clarity reigns supreme over everything. The conductor's seat is sort of, many recording engineers, the ideal. I work closely with a recording engineer and over the years, and because he was always interested in monitor loudspeakers, because once he has recorded something and plays it back, can he make valid judgments on his recording technique from what he hears over the loudspeakers there. It's sort of a loop. Floyd too likes to call it the circle of confusion. You know, you make recordings that sound good over the loudspeakers that you use, and you use loudspeakers that sound good for the recordings that you make. You know, so you're in a loop, in a circle of confusion here. And I think that's certainly valid and true. It's certainly true for what I'm doing here. But I would say you can change this circle of confusion into a circle of illusion, okay? And that illusion can be made stronger than we probably have done in the past. It's quite possible. But on the recording side, we have to do something more than just capturing the direct sound. And of course, people use different microphone techniques to do that. But for recording the direct sound, the ORTF technique of spaced cardioids, angles at 110 degrees, and a spacing of 17 centimeters has been developed as a standard by the French broadcasting companies in 1963 or so, after doing extensive experimentation with different microphone techniques and lots of listening tests there. And they sort of standardized on this setup. And I think it has some very good, valid attributes. It gives you delay between the microphones. It's not a coincident technique. It's something you might call it near coincident. And it picks up the frontal sound and attenuates the rear sound. But that also means that of this whole space, a technique like this doesn't pick up enough of this, the context in which music takes place. All sound always happens in a context, in a space, in the spatial characteristics. And so what we're experimenting with is to use a pair of omnis that are some distance behind and separated from each other. And the experimentation right now is, well, how far behind, how far apart. The first experiments were done with these microphones really far back, like 40 feet back, 30 feet apart, and the first recordings were done in Washington Cathedral in Washington, because that's where Don Banjo, a friend of mine, lives, and he had some access to some groups doing rehearsals in the cathedral there. Unfortunately, it's the kind of recording you cannot even show or give to anybody else there, so this is all right now a little bit just in an inner circle here. But then what you do is, with these four microphones, the end result is stereo left and right. The Omni microphones are mixed in with the cardioids, and well, how much of the level of the mix-in should there be, and that's still experimentation. But I would say the first experiments look very, very promising. He has another session coming up where we'll move the microphones a lot closer, like 10 feet behind and 10 feet apart, in that order of magnitude. Okay, enough about recording. So let me come to an end here and just talk about what are the impediments to recreating an auditory scene and recreating with some accuracy, recreating a good illusion there. And number one is the inadequate polar response of the typical loudspeaker. Well, you have an example hanging up here. There, something pretty omnidirectional at low frequencies, increasingly directional at high frequency, certainly doesn't illuminate the room in any uniform fashion there. Next is the loudspeaker placement too close to the walls and non-symmetrically. That often is the case because it's just not convenient to set the loudspeakers where they should optimally be. Room treatment with absorbers and diffusers which change the spectral content of reflections. Well, if you put on the side, particular people like to put things on the side walls, all you do is basically you turn down the travel because it attenuates the high frequencies. At low frequencies, they have no effect. Electronic room equalization above bass frequencies. Now, this could be a real hot topic to argue, because it's quite popular these days to use DSP, put a microphone where the listener sits, or maybe some other places in the room, take various averages or use various algorithms and come up with an equalization curve for the loudspeakers there. I contend that now you're messing with the processor between the ears, which is a lot more powerful than the DSP software that you have, and I would regard these attempts as to say, well, naive, I think, a little bit. And but at very low frequencies where you have room mode, certainly you can do something. But even there, when you do everything else, when you have a loudspeaker that illuminates the room evenly, surprisingly, the low end, even though it may be boom at a certain frequency, you say, well, it occurs only occasionally anyways in music reproduction. Say, yeah, the room is a little boomy here at that frequency, but it's not really something that changes the whole situation dramatically. Another thing here, problem with loudspeakers is usually that they have insufficient dynamic range. I think it's very important to play back at near realistic levels, and the reason for that is that the ear itself is not that linear. It has a huge dynamic range, but it is auto-ranging, so this range shifts up or down. If it's very loud, it's working up here. If it's very quiet, it's down here. Okay, it adjusts, has a gain control in there, but the range in itself is in the order of 30 dB or so, the linear range. And so you want to have the distortion generated in the outer ear, in the inner ear probably, there, because that's part of natural hearing. It affects the timbre that we perceive. The Fletcher-Munson curves give you an indication a little bit of what I'm talking about here. And coming back to the recordings, what's could be wrong or could be an impediment is recordings with too many microphones, spot microphones, which is done for clarity, and so you hear everything. I know San Francisco Symphony did a recording of the,
Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet, Prokofiev, Romeo and Juliet. They used 42 microphones, was done by RCA, then mixed down to two channels. And the aim was that, of course, all the individual instruments, different musicians, wanted to be properly presented when their part came in, and that they would be heard there. And the recording, you could say, was impressive. It won a Grammy. But when you listen to it and say, what am I listening to? It's sort of like, to me, it's like a smorgasbord. There is no real sense of a space in which this music is happening here. It's not natural. It has something artificial to it. But that doesn't mean that people wouldn't enjoy it. I mean, much of the recordings are done this way here. The other technique is that they use many microphones or record in a way that, in effect, all you hear is sort of what Keith Johnston called, when he was talking here, the sound sources on a clothesline. So you have all the sound sources here just spaced between the loudspeakers, but there's no depth to them. It's all very nice and clear, but it's sort of paper-thin presentation. And I think MP3 has a lot of that same effect there. It sort of makes the presentation very thin. All right. So here I'm talking about now two-channel stereo versus surround sound. What am I missing by not having surround sound? Well, with two channels, you never get a complete envelopment. It's just not physically possible. But you do get a sense of a space in front of you, and actually quite extended. It can easily go beyond the speakers. And you're gaining believability, because it just is very natural. One simple test that I always do is I sort of move my head, turn my head as I'm listening. You know, do the images stay where they were? Is it stable, spatially stable? You get a reproduction that can be highly satisfactory, to the point where you forget about the loudspeakers. You just get involved with the music. And this two channels basically a simple system. I have experimented with surround sounds and have set up surround sound. But after a while I said, well, yeah, maybe sometimes it does something good. But then just switching back to two channels with a system like this here, I find it just more believable, more satisfactory. But that may have a lot to do also with the recording techniques, because I have to say that I heard in the early days a DVD audio demo at one of the AES conventions. It was done with Chesky Recordings. Kevin Halverson from Muse was there, some other people. They had put together a demo with relatively simple loudspeakers, and that was, to me, one of these highlight experiences where I said afterwards, I have to have surround. This is absolutely the wonderful thing there. It was a kind of surround. It was some orchestral music that they played with chorus or so, where you had a wonderful sound stage in front of you. You were aware you were sitting in an auditorium, in a hall there. You were not aware of the loudspeakers by themselves. It was a six-speaker setup, two front, two elevated sort of front, and two side speakers, so also had the vertical dimension to it. Was done with an ambisonic microphone, and I thought it was really excellent. But I've never, since that time, ever heard a similarly convincing demo of surround sound. And I've heard things done by Sony, Meridian, and JBL, and big people. And I've said, I can't believe it that they demo something like this. You know, what goes on? So, anyways, you can tell I'm not too hip on the surround. It's fine for movies, it's effects. In movies, it's just multi-channel mono, you know, and it's fine there, you have a strong image. Okay, so to summarize it, two-channel playback in a normal living space can provide an experience that is fully satisfying. Loudspeakers and room disappear, and the illusion of listening into a different space takes over. So while you don't see the auditorium or the symphony hall in front of you, I find it useful to close your eyes, because the auditory cues can really be distracting from in your mind, forming the illusion of listening into an acoustic space and listening to just to the music. The loudspeakers disappear. They're just not there. And I have had this experience or observed quite often. People come there and say, particularly on these speakers, when I switch to these speakers, people are not even aware that I switched there. And they might say, what are these things over there? and I say, oh, yeah, that's what you're listening to. You know? So, okay. So I think that's enough for tonight. Thanks for your attention. Hope I didn't bore you. And if you have any questions, I'm willing to entertain. I don't know what the schedule is here, when we have to be out of here. But okay? Question?
For your comment on the dynamic range of loudspeakers, you missed the other end of it. A quote from Tom Holman, who at the time lived up in a quiet place in Marin County, and he said, what does 960 dB noise ratio really mean? It means I have to go in and unplug my refrigerator in order to hear all the music. It's hard to get from quiet to
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we were looking for a house, and we used to live in Santa Rosa, and when we looked for a house, my wife did most of the looking. I sent her around with a sound level meter. And one of the criteria was take some measurements. You know. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I work designing large sound reinforcement systems.
Yeah.
And I've done some papers on stereo reinforcement. The guy who most impressed me was William Snow at Bell Labs, who had the original stereo patent. And his concept was very different from the British concept. And there's a wonderful drawing in the AES Stereo Anthology where he shows how spaced pairs of microphones that correspond to spaced loudspeakers are self-compensating for the position of the listener. And this is absolutely key for listening anywhere but on center line with your head in the place. So that stuff that he did in 1934, 36, it's in the patent, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah, that's probably another example of things that were done at one time, then forgotten again, or not picked up. Yeah, I know, for instance, in the recording technique, the two omnis, the two spaced omnis, they do something very nice, you know, that is missing when you just use the cardioids in the ORTF thing. So there's something there that the brain wants that we want to have to recreate a good illusion. Please.
Mm-hmm. I've used for many years.
Okay.
And it does have a lot of virtues going for it, and it's particularly great for orchestral recording. But you're mentioning pulling the Omni outriggers, as I say, back, what, 40 feet, did you
yes,
say?
Yes, in the first
I
attempt.
I do that because I can't move them 40 feet back. I'm in an auditorium where you'd be in the audience. You know,
yeah.
But my technique is I very often use a pair of my labs in the center, which have rectangular capsules, sometimes even hypercardioid pattern. But I use Omni microphones some distance from the center pair, and I bring them up in the mix slowly but surely until it sounds just right. It's wonderful. You get this unbelievable spaciousness and a very smooth reproduction.
Yeah.
The other comment I wanted to make was a lot of people like to use space omnis for choral recording. I do that myself always, almost always. One of the problems with that, if you have an instrumental ensemble, is that certain instruments using a pair of spaced omnis, the spatial localization and capture of an instrument like an accordion will make it sound like the instrument is 15 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. If the person playing that instrument were to move ever so slightly, the exaggeration is unbelievable. It looks like he's walked 5 feet in either direction, and he may be turning this way.
Yeah.
I've had that happen a lot of times. Otherwise, it's wonderful. I just wanted to pass that on.
Yeah. That's
thank
good.
You. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the recording, how come the single pair in the front isn't enough? Is there a technical reason there's something that's missing?
Well, I don't know whether it's a technical reason. The sense is there is sort of, I like to express it, is there is not enough recording of the actual space there, of the reflection, of how the hall deals with the sound that is produced by the instruments. You pick up the direct sound, but not enough of the other. Don likes to call it the context in which the sound happens. You see? Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. This is another thing. I think what I'm talking about here, I try to find in the literature what's been studied and written about sound in rooms. And usually the experiments are done in anechoic chambers where you have control over the sources. You have very few sources. I mean, there's a lot of work done on reflections, single reflections, the effect, when do they become audible. But a real room is so much more complex that it's also very difficult to study. To set up an experiment and just change one parameter is very difficult in one room. So I must say I didn't find that much. Hartman has written quite a bit about it. Moore also, he actually had an interesting article about sort of mysteries and controversies in perception. There's still a lot of stuff that I don't think we have really categorized or understood fully. Yeah.
Another concept that I was thinking of, though, wouldn't it be possible to eliminate issues with at least back wall reflections by essentially embedding the loudspeakers in the wall such that they radiate into half space, thereby eliminating those reflections?
That's an interesting comment, and actually some long time ago I thought that's a way to go, you know, just build a speaker flush with the wall there and you don't at least have that reflection. But I have never heard a loudspeaker in the wall, including the stuff that I built, that sounded other than a speaker in the wall.
And
I don't know what I was doing wrong, I don't know, but that's the impression that I had. And maybe it is because we recognize there is something missing. There should be a reflection coming there. It's not there. And therefore, oh, it must be a wall that I'm listening to. I don't know how we process this there, but that certainly, I mean, it's sort of, you would say, obviously, just put it flush. To me, it just didn't work. Yeah. It would be very convenient. Women would love to have speakers flush in the wall with a curtain in front of it. And would be wonderful, yeah. If somebody comes up with doing it, if someone said, well, then let's just electronically delay the reflection that isn't there physically. Let's assume the speaker was set 3 feet in front of the wall, so you add a six millisecond echo to it. I don't know what that does. I haven't heard it, but it would be an interesting experiment how that comes across. Yeah. Yeah.
The singulated reflection does not. It doesn't change when the other real.
You're right. Yeah, and we use a lot of this movement to sort of analyzed, right?
There's a lot of arguments that the head movement is one of the primary factors that reduces the ambiguity of source location. In other words, if you're on the median plane, you have equal HRTFs to both ears. But if you manipulate that slightly, by just moving your head even small amounts, the relative shift in the relative levels helps you identify the actual location.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it's like trying to correct for HRTF electronically is not getting up with whatever HRTF you specify, not with your HRTF, unless you go to great lengths and you can't do that. But so it wouldn't be the same.
Mm-hmm.
I did hear a demonstration of exactly what you're talking about. It wasn't perfect, but it was very seriously done with impulse responses in an anechoic room for a particular people, and then a device that literally, as the head turned, it figured out where the head was and did the HRTFs on it.
Yeah,
I had this heard it's done at a university in Berlin about 2 years ago.
AKG just had that finished release.
I've heard similar things where you have head tracking and then fast computing of where the sound, listening over headphones, and but with head tracking. And that can be very impressive. I guess that's used in games, is it?
The problem with all of this electronic manipulation to try to cancel what's going on in space is that space is three-dimensional. And anywhere we take our head and anywhere we take the sound source, we're exciting those three-dimensional things at different points and in different ways. So mm-hmm. you can never cancel it at anything except one point in space for one set of conditions, and you tweak that an inch, and it all goes away.
Yeah.
Hmm. Hmm. So, analyzing the dipole and the monopole, you show they have fairly different responses in the room if we look in a 200 millisecond window. So, you know, looking at those, you would say those are pretty different, right, those two graphs.
Yes, I would say, I base it, they look different when I design a loudspeaker and I measure it under free field conditions. If it looked that different under free field conditions, I would say, well, these are very different, and I see irregularities in the response there. I would say, no, we better do something about those, you know. I think that's why people are very tempted if they do an in-room measurement and they see these wiggles and so on, they say, oh, geez, let's straighten it out, and now we can really do it with a little bit of DSP. It's very easy. But now you're beginning to interfere and fighting, I think. You're finding with a processor up here, which doesn't just work in the frequency domain. See, this is a time, 200 millisecond time record. Yes. The brain uses frequency or spectral information, but it also uses timing information, you know, direction of arrival of sounds there. And with the DSP, how are you going to handle that? Yeah.
Were both those loudspeakers pretty flat out in your outdoor development?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't say this. Good that you asked. I designed those speakers for free field conditions to be flat, like the Omni. To be flat on axis, of course, whatever the axis, well, the axis in this case is a tweeter axis here, right? And then as I move around it to maintain that flatness, well, I really couldn't do anything about it. I designed it for flat here, and then at other angles, it does what it does due to the physical dimensions of these structures here, right? And with the dipole, the same thing. Now, the dipole was the whole baffle size, width, details in there, was done with a lot of empirical work there, because I don't know of any software that would do the job for me there, with lots and lots of measurements there, building basically mock-ups or so, to come up with a structure that gives me, well, first of all, if that on-axis response, it's easy to get. I can always correct it electronically. But then as I move off-axis, all I want for the dipole that the magnitude drops down, but the general response stays the same, okay? In order to get the figure of eight radiation pattern. Okay? And the angle that I look over is plus minus 60 degrees, you know, off-axis, so pretty pretty wide. As you get into the null regions, the degree of cancellation is, it gets down, but really how far down changes very much with frequency.
And you found narrow baffle was important. You still think that?
Pardon?
Narrow baffle, you still find that important?
Narrow baffle than what I'm using?
Well, I think one of your goals for the dipole was to make it narrow, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You found that important at the time, and you
yeah, still yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
I have since done some more experiments with trying to get the baffle narrow, just some using smaller drivers also, but that didn't lead to anything useful.
But if I'm sitting in the center line, in a sweet spot, then does it really matter that it's broad, wide response?
Well, it matters because the reflection, I want the reflections to be copies of what's coming at you on the center line.
But as long as I have that, which I should have in most dipoles, right, even if it's a very narrow range, the reflections will still be copies.
No, I'm talking about the reflection coming off the side walls, floor, ceiling, wall behind. I should say also, when I talk about dipoles, I'm referring to like what you saw in the picture here, the dipole built with dynamic drivers. The dipoles are large panel type dipoles, electrostatics, magnetic, large panel dipoles. I'm not so terribly fond of those. And the reason for that is that they are just as radiator, they are too big. They become multi-directional. They're not at higher frequencies. And they're not just dipole, but they have fingers in their radiation pattern. They are beaming. They have nodes on each lobe is out of phase with the next one to it. You know, that's just the nature. I think that also makes them very critical to place in the room, because now what goes to the rear there is this finger type polar response, and if you have any particular specular reflection there, it will interfere. It makes a sweet spot extremely tight. That's another thing with this recording technique that I'm describing here, and also with these speakers in general. The sweet spot is not that tight. You can move. With the Omnis, you can sit quite a ways off axis there, and still the sound stage is over there. Mm-hmm. I think we should close it up here.
Yeah,
right?
One more question.
No, you had your share.
So when you're talking about doing the plus minus 60 degrees, how do you end up selecting the crossover frequency on the high end of your mid-range one for that?
Yeah, there was a lot of trial and error, basically. Yeah. And it was done for at the time, I had only a single tweeter. I didn't go into that. I had a single tweeter. So these days, now that I have a tweeter in front and back, I probably should go back and look at that whole area again, you know, whether it really is as optimum as it could be. Yeah. But I haven't done that. It's right now I'm pretty happy with the way it goes there, so I'm getting lazy to do this stuff.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Do we have to be out of here by a certain time?
9:00.
9:00? Oh. Okay. Well, I was going to play you just. I put on a CD here.
Play it.
And as we walk out the room.
Okay. That's your walk out.
Publications section of my website. Mm-hmm. This is a paper that I did on stereo in large rooms. Hello,
By the way, it isn't the Haas effect, it's the Henry effect. Joseph Henry figured this out. Yeah. I don't care.